Our next case this morning is number 063629, Eberts against Torge Gutterstad and American Family Insurance. Mr. Monroe.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I represent the defendants and appellants in this case who are being sued for damages allegedly arising out of the sale of their home. The plaintiffs are claiming that the defendants made various misrepresentations to induce the sale. The issue before the Court today in this case is whether American Family, the defendant's liability insurance carrier, owes the defendants a defense against those claims. The answer to that question is yes, because both the fifth and sixth claims for relief in the amended complaint allege all three of the elements necessary to trigger a duty of defense: property damage, including loss of use to tangible property, an occurrence, and a causal nexus between the two. I start with the fifth claim for relief, which seeks recovery under Section 100.18 of the Wisconsin statutes, a consumer protection statute which prohibits a seller from making any untrue, misleading, or incomplete statement, assertion, or representation of fact to induce the sale. As the law stands today, the coverage law, the law of insurance coverage for this kind of a statutory claim is governed by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision in Stewart versus Weisflog, 2006 Wis App 184, 296 Wis Second 249.
Well, that's the case under advisement at the
that
present
is correct.
Time by the Supreme Court of Wisconsin, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, Your Honor. And but for that review, I submit that that case would be dispositive. And the reason, because it's under review by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, we have respectfully requested that you certify to the Wisconsin Supreme Court the question of whether American Family's policy in this case provides coverage for the statutory violation claim.
Why well, certify if yeah. the court's going to decide the case in a couple of months?
Well, then perhaps you could simply take it under advisement for long enough to let the Wisconsin Supreme Court come to that conclusion, Your Honor.
Yeah, so holding the case, it seems to me, makes the most sense until we hear, because by the time we go through the certification process and drag that out, I mean.
Well, I think that would probably be a very practical alternative rather than going through the certification process.
Less expensive to the client, to your client and to your colleague's client as well.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's true. And I think it's particularly appropriate because of one of the holdings in the Stewart case, which was affirmed in the Supreme Court's decision on the liability aspects in Stewart, which is that violations of administrative regulations of the type that were involved in Stewart, which are promulgated pursuant to Section 100.20 of the Wisconsin statutes, are to be read in paramateria with Section 100.18 WIST stats, and that decisions interpreting either the regulations or the statute, in the words of the Stewart Court, inform our view of the other. So I think that's important. Another, I think, important holding in the Stewart case is that different rules apply to administrative and statutory misrepresentation claims on the one hand and common law misrepresentation claims on the other, and that the limitations that the appellate courts in Wisconsin have placed on common law misrepresentation claims do not always apply to these claims for statutory and administrative misrepresentation claims. That holding was also affirmed in the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision, at least with respect to the application of the economic loss doctrine in cases involving administrative misrepresentation claims. By the way, I have provided the court and counsel with copies of the Supreme Court's Stewart decision under Federal Appellate Rule 28J. The other point is in the appellate decision, knowledge of falsity and intent to mislead or deceive are not required for liability under the administrative regulation that was involved in that case and applying the doctrine of in paramateria to 100.18 claims. Therefore, a violation of that regulation can be an accident and therefore an occurrence with respect to liability insurance.
Well, that's not quite right, though. The statute requires an intent to induce the transaction.
That's true, but not
so
to
it's not an intent-free
it's an intent
cause
to,
of action.
To cause the sale, but not intent to deceive or to in any way defraud the individual.
Right, so that it doesn't regulate accidental misrepresentations because they have to be made with intent to induce the transaction at issue.
True. The representation has to be made for a particular purpose, but it does not have to be made with intent to deceive. And therefore, if a person speaks and makes a misrepresentation under the statute, that because there's no intent element, it can be an accident and therefore an occurrence.
Well, under the Everson case, which is the Supreme Court's most closely analogous decision, the volitional act of making the representation with intent to induce the transaction, even though intent to deceive is not necessary, is enough to take it outside the coverage language of an occurrence under the policy.
That is correct with respect to common law claims for negligent misrepresentation by negligent disclosure.
Right. Why doesn't that apply with equal force to the statutory claim?
That's precisely that's one of the two issues that is now that was decided by the Court of Appeals in Stewart and is now before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and that's why we've been discussing holding your decision on that issue until the Wisconsin Supreme Court gets to speak to that specific issue.
Well, there's also a separate issue here, which is to say the property damage issue. The policy, as most of these do, covers only property damage arising out of an occurrence.
Yes.
And so even if we were to hold the case pending a decision from the Wisconsin Supreme Court on the occurrence issue, we've got a subsidiary issue on whether a claim of this sort is one for property damage, because the measure of damage is of course, pecuniary in terms
Correct.
Of financial losses, what the difference in the value of the property as represented versus the value of the property as transferred is the measure of the damages.
That issue is addressed in three cases. First of all, there's Smith versus Katz. Then there is the decision in Stewart again. And then we talk about the Jarris versus Ulrich case. In Smith versus Katz, the Wisconsin Supreme Court did acknowledge that a properly drafted complaint in a misrepresentation case can allege property damage. The court said the complaint must make some statement of physical damage, loss of use, or demand some damages beyond economic damages. And if you take a look at the amended complaint in this case, it alleges that there is water staining and mold growth, which the Court of Appeals in Stewart said cannot be anything other than property damage. It said that in Jarris, the Court of Appeals said that the allegation of necessary repair costs necessarily implies property damage. And we have both of those allegations in the amended complaint here, plus a claim, a demand for damages for loss of use while the property is being repaired. So I think we have adequate allegations of property damage in this case. So the other point that I would like to make is with respect to the question of occurrence under the sixth claim for relief, and I'm going to talk briefly about negligent nondisclosure. As you pointed out in Everson, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said negligent disclosure is a volitional act, notwithstanding lack of knowledge of falsehood. But it didn't touch the question of negligent nondisclosure.
Nondisclosures are not actionable under Section 118.
That's true, but they may be actionable under common law, under the sixth claim for relief for negligent misrepresentation, because the Everson Court never addressed that issue. And I submit to you that nobody can intentionally know something, forget about it, and fail to tell it, and that constitutes a volitional act. I submit to you that a negligent non-representation, failure to disclose, is a non-volitional act, can constitute an accident, and therefore can constitute an occurrence under the policy. Finally, I think the Jarris causation analysis with respect to the sixth claim for relief, negligent misrepresentation, applies here because of the claim of loss of use. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court characterized the Jarris analysis as there being a sufficient allegation of causation nexus where the complaint alleges misrepresentations result in loss of use. We have that here. And I don't think Everson requires a different result because Supreme Court said there was no allegation of loss of use in that case, and because of the differences in the pleadings in Everson and in this case, the Jarris analysis of causation applies and not the Everson analysis. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Monroe. We'll hear now from Mr. Booth.
May it please the Court. My name is Terry Booth. I represent American Family Mutual Insurance Company. This case is one that is controlled by many precedents and a long line of precedents of Wisconsin law. And those precedents are controlling in this case.
Well, what's your view of us holding the case until we get a final resolution on Stewart versus Weisslaw?
I don't think it's necessary, Your Honor. There are two bases that we have stated that would allow this court to affirm the decision of the district court. The one is the one that relates to Stewart. The second one is the one that relates to the causal nexus issue. Stewart does not deal with that issue. We have two separate, independent, self-sufficient bases for upholding the district court decision. The first is that there was no occurrence. You have to have an occurrence in order to have coverage. The second is that there was no causal nexus. You have to have a causal nexus between a wrong and a damage in order to have coverage.
The intermediate appellate court in Stewart, though, touch on the question of, or actually permit a showing, I guess, that a party could say that but for the misrepresentation, they never would have incurred the damages. Indeed, they never would have purchased the property.
In the Stewart case, Your Honor?
I just wonder if the causation question is really not up for grabs in the current litigation before the Supreme Court of Wisconsin.
I don't think that it is, Your Honor. I mean, Stewart deals with a completely different scenario. It deals with a Home Improvement Act situation and misrepresentations in that context, and it dealt with the occurrence issue. There are a whole line of cases that deal directly with this issue in the same context that we have here, the context of a real estate transaction where the purchaser is selling the seller. We have that in the Everson case, in the Benjamin case, in the Qualman case, in Smith versus Katz, in Ehlers versus Johnson. There's a long line of cases. In each of those cases, there was alleged misrepresentations with regard to the sale. In all of those cases, the court held that there was no coverage, and those cases dealt with the issue of whether or not there was a causal nexus. And I think that the most recent case on that issue, the Everson case, the Supreme Court case, is the one that is authoritative.
Well, why shouldn't we view Everson narrowly in light of the typographical error there? I mean, someone affirmatively typed in the wrong lot number in Everson, but do we have a comparable volitional act here?
Your Honor, I think that the fact that we have that kind of an error in Everson is actually very supportive of our position. The distinction that the Stewart case made with Everson was that the court said in Stewart that Everson dealt with common law misrepresentations, and the statute 100.18 supposedly is an intent-neutral statute. And Stewart said, well, Everson doesn't apply because it doesn't apply to intent-neutral situations. I think that the point that you just brought up demonstrates that, in fact, Everson does apply to intent-neutral situations. There was a mistake made. It was a typographical error. It was negligence. It was a mistake. It was something that was done incorrectly. Yet the court then, based on the subsequent representation, held that representation alone, the making of that representation, the act of making that representation, was the thing that was controlling. So it is the act of the representation that is made and not the antecedent mistake that is controlling. And there was a discussion in the Everson case between the majority and the dissenting opinion about what you focus on. And I think that it became very clear that in Everson it is simply the act of the representation that is the thing that you look at and not the antecedent mistake that caused that volitional act to be done. And I think that if you look at the cases that are cited in Everson, And there's a long line of them from a number of different settings. Everson relies on Red Ball. That's a decision issued by this court. City of Jasper, another decision by this court. And in Red Ball, the court cited to a number of cases from a number of jurisdictions that dealt with this same issue. You look at those various cases, you see that it is the act of making the representation or the act of doing something, a volitional act, and not the antecedent purpose of that act, be it a mistake, be it an intent to deceive, whatever's behind it, it just doesn't make any difference. It is the act of making the representation that is the key thing and is the important thing, and I think that is demonstrated by the facts of Everson and by the facts of the various cases that are cited in Everson. So I think that first of all, Stewart is a very different case from this one. Stewart is, it's been suggested that Stewart resolves this issue. Stewart didn't deal with 100.18. Stewart is based on 100.20, a very different statutory section. It deals with home improvement acts. It does not deal with sale of real estate. Those are very different transactions. There are two statutes in the same chapter. If you have two different statutory sections in the same chapter, the courts and the legislature doesn't like to have surplusage, so there must be some difference there. One provides for double damages, one does not. These are very different statutes. So to say that a reference in Stewart to 100.18 means that Stewart controls 100.18 is simply wrong. Stewart deals with 100.20. It deals with the Home Improvement Act. It does not deal with 100.18, and it especially does not deal with 100.18 in the face of the Everson case. The Stewart case tried to distinguish Everson, but that distinction, I think, as we've discussed already, is one that just doesn't hold up, because Everson is an intent-neutral situation. It applies to intent-neutral representations and intent-neutral acts. And because of that, Everson is the controlling authority on this point of occurrence. Now, in addition to the occurrence argument, there is the causal nexus position, and that is a position that is long established in Wisconsin law. Counsel mentioned the cases that he likes on that point, the Jars case, but he ignores the fact that there's Benjamin versus Doms, Qualman versus Bruckmoser, Everson, Ehlers versus Johnson. All of those cases deal with the same situation, and they all find that there is no coverage under these circumstances because there is not a causal connection. I think we look to the Everson case again to find out which of the various cases is controlling. The court in Everson did a little bit of a summary of the cases on the causal nexus point. It did refer to the Jarvis case. And then it also referred to the Benjamin and Qualman cases and said that the Supreme Court in Smith versus Katz relied on and followed Benjamin and Qualman. It ignored Jarvis. I think Benjamin and Qualman are cases that they were in existence prior to Jarvis. They are a controlling authority. Everson was decided after Jarvis. It is a Supreme Court case. It is controlling authority, and it said that it followed Benjamin and Qualman and the rationale specifically of those cases that even if you have property damage, you need to have a causal nexus, and misrepresentations do not cause property damage. It is the condition of the property that causes the property damage. Misrepresentations cause economic damages, and economic damages are not covered by insurance policies. So we ask the court to, for those two separate and independent bases, to affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Booth. How much time does Mr. Monroe have? Thank you.
Thank you. I would point out that in Benjamin, Qualman, and Everson, there was no allegation for loss of use damages. That's present in this case. It's present in Jarrett's. Loss of use does constitute property damage, and loss of use can occur after the transaction has occurred and the owners have taken possession of the property. So the misrepresentation can cause loss of use and, therefore, property damage. The causal, it's very in Stewart, it's very interesting. The court used decisions construing Section 100.18 in its analysis of the consumer protection regulations involved in that case, and both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court have said that those regulations and 100.18 are in paramateria. The question of the Volitional Act applies to common law misrepresentation claims. It does not apply to cases, at least under the Court of Appeals decision in Stewart, does not apply to statutory misrepresentation claims, and in fact, so those are the points that I would like to make at this time, and if the court has no further questions, then I would be done.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
The court thanks both Mr. Monroe and Mr. Booth for their briefs and oral argument today, and we will take the case under advisement.